This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
Broadcasting across the state of Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network and around the world on the Civic Media app, this is the Dom Salvia Show. And now, here's your host, Dom Salvia.
Hey, Dom's not here. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm guest hosting along with Angela Lang from Block. I want to invite you to join the conversation, 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. You can call or text. I'm going to read a couple texts we've gotten. One was from Susan from McFarland, passing along her thanks to Hans. That's Hans Brayton Moser, who was our guest in the last half hour, a dairy farmer from Lincoln County, advocate for Fair Maps, wonderful guy. Susan thanks him for being a farmer and for advocating for immigrant rights. We also got a text from Steady Eddie, who says, Matt, I'm not buying the idea that meat packers, construction workers, and dairy workers must, that's all caps, I guess he's getting that from Trump, must be paid a substandard wage to make these businesses work. He goes on, Steady Eddie does, at least I know my dad made pretty good union wages with benefits, health insurance, and a pension in the meatpacking industry not that long ago. And that's, of course, part of the problem. I don't think that Hans was advocating for substandard wages, but he was saying, look, all these industries would not survive without immigrant labor right now. And the fact is that, you know, our minimum wage hasn't gone up in decades here in Wisconsin. It's unbelievable. It's still stuck at $7.25, which is not a livable wage by any stretch, barely a subsistent wage, even that. So, yeah, we got a lot of work to do to make sure that people get paid what they deserve in this country.
And the governor is going around doing his listening sessions for the budget. And I think that could be a good opportunity. I mean, we all know. I mean, I'm not going to be naive and say that whatever the governor proposes in his budget, including raising the minimum wage, is going to be what passes. But I think it's also another opportunity to continue the conversation. And we actually, you know, our team sat down with the governor's office last week, and that was one of the things that we mentioned, is that we want to actually tackle some of the issues in our community. You have to raise people's wages.
What are some of the other issues you raised with governor's team?
Education. I think education is important. We had talked to a lot of our coalition partners, especially a lot of teachers and folks that are doing work in the education space, around the special education funding gap and how that needs to be closed. You know, I dabbled it a little bit into Representative Pocan talking about putting cops back in schools, and Milwaukee public schools are a bit of a challenge right now, unfortunately. And, you know, we hear Robin Voss say that, you know, Milwaukee public schools may not get funded because of the cops back in schools issues and them not complying with that, unfortunately. So those are a couple of things that we had talked about. And then circling back, obviously, being able to do whatever we can to decrease mass incarceration as well.
Which leads to this question back about cops and schools. And, you know, I wanted to get your take. Again, we talked about it with Representative Pocan about the Abundant Life shooting there. What you termed the knee-jerk reaction to try to get cops in schools or metal detectors in schools. For someone who's listening thinking, well, hell, I'd rather have metal detectors in schools and cops in schools than risk the lives of our kids. How do you respond to that?
And at first, I want to say I hear that. And I want to preface this by saying that I am not a parent. I think I want to share a little bit why, you know, as a Black woman, and I don't talk about this often, you know, as I get older, I get more and more firm in my belief in to not have children of my own. And that's due to the state of the world, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of parents and the fear that they have, and just try to keep your child safe. And so I understand people wanting to say, you know, well, maybe this is what we need. We need to fortify the schools. But I actually don't think that that's enough. We need to be getting to the more root cause of the problem. Why are guns even happening in our schools to a point where we need to fortify the schools? Like, fortifying the school is still only a Band-Aid on actually trying to solve and tackle the problem. And we also know that this extra kind of policing in schools also has an adverse effect and just ends up putting students and largely students of color on the school to prison pipeline and all the effects that happens with that as well.
Yeah, it's a tricky issue because, you know, I know a colleague of ours or someone we've worked in coalition with who agrees with you on this issue, but she's got a couple kids and she said every morning she hugs her kids before they get on the school bus and worries whether they're going to come back. I mean, that's just got to be horrible. I mean, my wife Jean and I raised three kids here in Madison, and they're grown now. But yeah, it was a concern back then too. Not so much as it is today. It's just such a huge concern now. And Monday's shooting, I mean, I was talking with a father of a firefighter who was getting the bulletins as they were coming in. I was talking with a retired police officer whose son was a detective who was going to the scene. My wife was a school nurse for many years. I mean, it struck so close to home for those of us here in Madison this week. It's just been kind of shocking. Not unexpected because, you know, like I grew up in Highland Park, Illinois, and they had that 4th of July parade shooting there. And
yeah,
so it's like, I know it can happen anywhere. You know, we've just been lucky. And then we had the Mount Horeb thing that Representative Pocan referenced earlier. So this is a crisis that our country is facing. You know, it's horrifying, the number of school shootings. I mean, I almost laugh because it's just such a shocking, appalling indictment of our country that there's so many school shootings going on in this country.
We need to attack our gun culture, you know, this like obsessive, toxic culture and obsession with guns that, you know, if we do something about that culture, we wouldn't feel the need to have to fortify the schools. Like, our kids should be in thriving environments, not ones that feel that they're walking into a prison. That's not a healthy environment for students to actually learn and succeed. And we've also seen that, you know, does not also keep students safe, because we've seen when they're school resource officers, we've seen even in Uvalde when there were police officers on the scene and they still didn't go in and act, right? And
so that was having terrible.
You know, we've seen that it actually doesn't work. And so, again, if we really want to tackle the actual problem, it's not by putting a Band-Aid over and say, oh, well, at least we'll catch the guns if they come in school. No, guns shouldn't even come into schools to the point where we even need metal detectors in the first place.
Hmm. Yeah, it's such a horror to be here in the wake of this shooting
again.
Again and again and again. I also... you know, I do want to take issue briefly with what the mayor of Madison was doing yesterday when she was scolding reporters for wanting to know the names of the victims. I know she was saying, look, give people, here, I'll read what she said. When the reporters were just asking for the name of the teacher who died and the name of the student who was killed, and also the substitute teacher who was wounded. And there's been no information forthcoming from either the mayor's office or the police department's office, police office. Here she was saying, it's absolutely none of y'all's business who was harmed in this incident. Well, you know, we live in this community. We live in this state. Right. It's been 48 hours. And I don't want to sound callous. You know, we all feel for the families who have been impacted by this. Absolutely. But the families have been notified and the public has a right to know who was impacted here. And I just think that stiff arm of the media is just not a good thing. It's not a good thing when it comes from Donald Trump, and it's not a good thing when it comes from the Madison mayor. I wonder what your take on that is, Angela.
Yeah. So I saw that clip actually on social media. It was making the rounds and I was looking at the comments and there was a lot of supportive comments. And for me, you know, watching it, I was kind of surprised, but also not, because I think it was very clear that is the passion of an elected official that is grieving just like everyone else. And I think that's something to be respected. You know, for me, I'm torn because I, on one hand, I understand what she was getting at of, you know, let's, the families kind of grieve, because once the names are listed, I can imagine the journalists that are going to be, you know, not necessarily respecting their privacy and you're trying to put cameras in their faces. And so I get wanting to shield the families from that. And I think she, you know, said it just in a very passionate way that I think was unexpected for some. But I, in some ways I get where she's coming from, but I also understand that people want to move to a point of healing. And that includes knowing the names and who was impacted. Is it someone that someone knows? Is it a loved one? Is it someone who's a coworker, you know, family member, right? I think on one hand, people want to support the grieving families and are eager to do so. So I get the need for wanting to release the names. But, you know, when I was reflecting on it and trying to think of like why she was, you know, saying that in that way, it's like, think about the families that, you know, the media, and we know sometimes the media can be a little callous too. They're not always respectful in the most sensitive times. And I think if there were more instances where some media, and again, this is not civic media, but there's always that quote, if it bleeds, it leads. And people tend to stick cameras in people's faces in the worst times. And I think she was just trying to avoid some of that, unfortunately.
Yeah, and let me give a fuller quote from the mayor to be fair to her. Here's also what she said along the lines that Angela's been talking about right now. Please have some human decency and respect for the people who lost loved ones or were injured themselves or whose children were injured. Just have some human decency, folks. Leave them alone. Let them grieve. Let them recover. Let them heal. Don't feed off their pain. We'll share what we can when we can and not before that. Strong statement. I think she's wrong on it as far from a First Amendment public right to know journal. I've been a journalist for 40 years. I want the information to get out.
That's, yeah,
that's in my blood. But I mean, no one wants the reporter shoving that mic in the crying mother's face saying, how do you feel? I mean, and that's not the kind of journalism that, you know, I want to see or that we would do here at Civic Media.
Yeah.
Whose coverage I've got to say, you know, I thought, Maggie did a great job the day of. I thought Todd did a great job the day of and the day after. Really hard, live conversations to have, holding it together, dealing with everyone's grief, shock, anger, and handling it with real grace. I admired it a great deal. We did have a text that I'm going to want your answer for, Angela, after the break. I'm going to throw it out there, though. Metal detectors are in courthouses, airports, concert events. We say to install them, not to install them in school. Why not? So, well, I'll get your answer on that. You're listening to the Dom Salvia Show. I'm Matt Rothschild. That's Angela Lang. We're co-hosting today. Dom's off. We'll be right back. Not to put too fine a point on it. Say I'm the only bee in your bonnet. Make a little birdhouse in your soul. While you're at it, keep the light light on inside the birdhouse in your soul. Not to put too fine a point on it. Say I'm the only bee in your bonnet. Make a little birdhouse in your soul. While you're at it, keep the night light on inside the birdhouse in your soul. Not to put too fine a point on it. Say I'm the only bee in your bonnet. Make a little birdhouse in your soul.
You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Hey, Matt Rothschild with you on the Dom Salvia Show. I'm guest hosting along with Angela Lang. We're handling it together, dealing with all the issues and your texts. You can text or call at 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. I want to tease our next guest who's going to come on after the 5:30 break, Wisconsin Poet Laureate Nick Gulig. He's been Poet Laureate for 2 years. He's got about 3 weeks left. And so I very much look forward to speaking with him for you poetry lovers out there. But we're going to continue this conversation about the shooting. I've got a couple comments on the text line. Annie from Watertown. I guess Annie's on the phone, actually. Is that right, Jess? So we'll take that call.
That's correct. All right. Annie, you're on.
Oh, okay. I think, you know, the gun violence has immediate results that we can look at, but it's all about our values. We send our kids out the door. What are they exposed to? the rising cancer rates in children is something you don't hear about, much less what kind of planet they're going to have. And that says nothing about the psychological perversions we're doing with their, with not only the drills they have to go through, but we're, they're told their teachers are scum and there's lead in the water, but that's okay. And yeah, I mean, they listen, they can hear, they hear in a different way too. So they, what we're doing to them is bigger than the gun violence.
Yeah, Annie from Watertown, thanks for that thoughtful comment. It is a harsh world out there for our kids, much harsher than when I was growing up. And I understand what you were saying earlier, Angela, about not wanting to bring a child into this situation. You know, it's not pretty. And, you know, I feel for the parents. I feel for the kids. We also have a text from Cam from Appleton disagreeing with me, saying that giving the names out, if the mayor or the police chief gave the names out of the victims, that would make it so bad for the victim's digital footprint, given the day and age we live in.
Sure.
And that could be, you know, I hear that side of the argument as well. But just as someone who likes public information to be public, this is a public event. The police is a public entity. The police is, has investigated and knows the names. The people, the citizens under our Constitution have a right to get that information, I believe. So I'm with Bill Leaders of the Freedom of Information Council here in Wisconsin, who says we should have the names as well. Interested in what anyone else has to say on this subject. But Angela, I said before the break, I'd give you another swing at PJ's question about metal detectors.
Yeah. So one, some of the places that were kind of named in that question were, you know, airports and courthouses. Yes, absolutely. We should have metal detectors there because those are federal, you know, buildings and places that just, it's a completely different environment. It is not a learning environment. The second thing is, if there are, if you know a school has metal detectors, you're just going to find a different way. And unfortunately, if you are that unwell, I don't think a metal detector will stop you, but what will stop you is policies limiting your access to a firearm. That's one thing that actually stops. And you know, the last thing that I'll mention, and I preface this by saying in another hat, because I have all this apparently spare free time, I'm vice president of the ACLU of Wisconsin. And during the break, I cheated and pulled up the ACLU statement. And what they say is, metal detectors are expensive, disruptive, alienating, and come hand in hand with aggressive police tactics and have a racially disparate impact on students of color. Like other surveillance methods, they are not good for kids, and ample research suggests that metal detectors don't improve school safety. Even the U.S. Secret Service has concluded that the devices are unlikely to stop school shootings. And so if we are putting all this money into kind of fortifying a school, we also understand we're living, especially in the state of Wisconsin, in an age where our schools are being defunded. And so when we need to prioritize how we're supporting our schools, I would much rather that money go into the curriculum to make sure that students have arts and recess and gym and all of these things that are being taken away, instead of metal detectors where they feel like they're walking into a prison every single time they go into a place of learning.
Yeah, I totally get that it's not conducive to learning. We've got a text from Angie from Monroe. Every time I hear of a shooting, I tell my grandkids, eyes and ears open, I love you. Yeah, for the grandparents and the parents who are sending their kids out to school, it's just such a hard time. Here's another text from Tyler from Columbia County. As an educator, metal detectors will be impossible to install in schools without major changes. You're asking 400 plus districts to install TSA style metal detectors in all schools. Our district alone is five buildings processing thousands of students. Unless you want to drop off your kids at six or pick them up at five, it's impossible to process. So, you know, there's the reality of it. Yeah.
Who's going to pay for it?
And our schools are already broke. That's why, you know, all these districts had to go to referendums.
We've talked about this, you know, We've had so many conversations, you know, Rep-elect Christian Phelps and, you know, Rep Fran Hong, who have talked about education and ran on education being strong in our community and bringing funding back to our schools. If there is extra funding for our schools, it should not go to things that have already been proven to not actually work and have actually negative and harmful reactions to students as well. But I get, and again, I want to just preface this by saying I understand why parents feel that that, you know, at any means is if I understand why parents would make them, metal detectors would make them feel safer given the current conditions. You want to do whatever you can to protect your child at the end of the day. When you drop them off at the bus, when they go outside, they walk to school, you want to protect them. And I think it's through these conversations that we connect the dots and actually unpack critically, you know, some of the research and data that's out there to say that actually that's not the best solution for our kids.
And Angela, I really appreciate you bringing that data and those facts forward on this issue, because it's so knee-jerk the reaction that we often have on this. Paul from Madison, Texas, if the victims don't want their names released, respect their rights. Well, I'm not with you on that, Paul. I want the information out there. But I hear you. I understand it. I get it. You're listening to The Dom Salvia Show. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm a guest co-host along with Angela Lang of Block. We'll be right back for a little poetry with the poet laureate of the state of Wisconsin on The Dom Salvia Show.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
I can see it in your eyes. You're not satisfied at all. You're too hot for some.
Hey, Matt Rothschild with you here on the Dom Salvia Show. Dom's off today, so I've been with you for the last hour and a half, and with you for this half hour with Angela Lang, Executive Director of Block, Black Leaders Organizing for Communities. And we have Poet Laureate Nick Gulick, Wisconsin's own Poet Laureate, on the program. First, I want to read a couple texts, and then we'll get right to some poetry or some discussion with the Poet Laureate, which is so cool, I think. So I'm in the distinct minority, evidently, for listeners, or at least texters to this show, on the question as to whether we should know the names of the victims of this terrible tragedy that happened on Monday. Paul from Madison says that the victims don't want their names released, respect their right. Monica writes, I agree with the mayor and the person with the digital footprint comment. I think the family should direct the narrative as to how they want their loved ones remembered instead of someone digging up info that may be incorrect or incomplete. Eric from Lodi writes, I agree with the mayor and the person with the digital footprint comment. I think the family should direct.
No, that was a mistake for me. Says sorry.
Here's
Matt.
Eric. I got it, Matt. I'm not in favor of subjecting the victims to the Alex Joneses of the world. I don't want that either. But until we can put a stop to that kind of First Amendment abuse, we'll have to respect their wishes. Says Eric. But what does this mean? We're, you know, how long are you gonna wait on this? How long before, or is it never? And I don't think it's never. So then the question is, what is the time frame? And all of that. But let's leave that conversation to the side and deal with something that I wanted to get to today, and that is Wisconsin Poet Laureate Nick Gulick. He's been Poet Laureate for 2 years. He just has a couple weeks left. I'm curious, Nick, first of all, thanks for joining the show.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
What's it been like to be Poet Laureate of the state of Wisconsin?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that it's been very busy and very tired, but I'm also incredibly grateful, and especially here as I come to the end of my tenure, and I have the chance to sit and reflect on the last 2 years, which is, I think, something you do when something's about to be done. One of the thoughts that keeps coming back to me is this idea that traveling the state for the last 2 years and talking with people about poems has returned my state to me in many ways. And it's also unexpectedly returned my craft to me at the same time. And I think that's one of the first thoughts that comes to mind.
Return the state to you. How? Why?
Well, one of the stories that I tell, and that I tell often, is of returning to Wisconsin in the aftermath of my father's passing. My dad died in 2015. I was living in Thailand at the time, and at that point I decided I needed to come back to Wisconsin. I wanted to be closer to my mother, to my family, after living the vast majority of my adult life away, first for school and then abroad. I was living in Thailand when he passed. And then in 2016, I had the opportunity through a job at the University of Whitewater to move back to Wisconsin. And I'm moving to Fort Atkinson in the summer of 2016. And if folks can remember what Wisconsin was like in the summer of 2016, like so much of rural America, that part of the state where I was driving through and moving to was drenched in their rhetoric and the symbols of the MAGA movement, which was then and is now deeply xenophobic amongst a cacophony of other ailments. And so for the first time in my life, I felt like I no longer belonged in the place where I was born. And then when Trump eventually won the election, I felt even further disconnected, because I'm the son of an immigrant, my wife and daughter, who I was in the process of immigrating to the United States, were immigrants. But then my community in Fort Atkinson, which was then and is now like deeply steeped in the legacy of Lori Niedeker, welcomed me. My community in Madison, which is filled with some of the best writers in the world, welcomed me. And then eventually, when I became the state's 10th laureate, the state welcomed me. I spent 2 years traveling the state and meeting people and talking to people in corners of the state I didn't even know existed. I saw more of Wisconsin in 2 years than I saw in the 40 odd years prior. And these people welcomed me into their spaces, into their homes, into their thoughts and conversations. And through those conversations and through those encounters with people, I came to feel at home again. That was a gift I wasn't expecting when I first took on the position 2 years ago.
But it's odd, because it's a book ended by Trump and by MAGA.
It's come full circle in the worst way possible.
And how do you wrestle with that? How do you deal with that?
Deal with like Trump being president again, or just deal with
Trump being president? All the, like, I live in a 10 miles south of Madison. There were a lot of Trump signs in the little subdivision I'm in. And right after the election, I felt like, for the first time, I've been there 10 years, I felt like moving. I said, I can't be here anymore. It was so visceral. And it was just in my face. And I've gotten over that now, but I just wonder how you deal with that in your face.
There's a couple things I think I can say to that. The first thing I think that I should say to that is, living in a small town, I have friends and neighbors who voted for Trump. And they are real friends and they are real neighbors. These are people who I know outside of the limits of their politics. And I'm a person who needs to believe, I can't say if this is true or not, but I need to believe that I am bigger than my politics, and I And if I'm bigger than my politics, I have to grant other people the possibility of being bigger than their politics. And so, because I live with people who voted for Trump, and because they're a part of my life and a part of, you know, a lot of them are my daughters, the parents of my daughter's friends. And these people have been a part of my life, and I trust my children with them, and they trust their children with me, you know, in the way that like parents who are raising children together in a community do at our best. And so I have in my recent memory unmediated experiences with people that complicate the MAGA narrative. And so I lean on that a lot. That being said, it doesn't undo or lessen any of the criticisms that I have of the MAGA movement. It complicates the movement for me in a way that I think is healthy, but it doesn't lessen my abhorrence.
And how do we get through to those people? I mean, this is similar to a conversation we had an hour ago with, with Hans Breitenmoser in Lincoln County, a dairy farmer who had a friend who was coming over to look at his cow's hoofs. And that guy was for Trump, and he knows that guy. He knows he's not an evil person. But how do we, what inroads can we make? I mean, you write in your poetry a lot about, you know, some of these issues, big political issues of racism and war and empire and things like that. And I'm just wondering, neighbor to neighbor, how do we get through to people?
I mean, I do not have an answer for you.
I'm looking for answers.
I mean,
answers for my own neighborhood too. So
for me, there's like two planes on which this conversation operates for me. There's like my day-to-day like lived experience, and then there's the way that I think about it, you know. So there's like there's a world of things and the world of ideas, and I'm trying to hold those two things together, and they don't necessarily mesh. In the world of a thousand things on a day-to-day basis, I treat my neighbors the way that I would want to be treated, regardless of who they are. And no one has treated me poorly. You know, no one has treated my children poorly. I mean, not really. But then there's the world of ideas. And I think that's where I'm having the hardest struggle, because I'm very, very nervous, because I know that the world of ideas overlaps with the world of things, and it slips down into and affects, and in this case, potentially poisons. And for me, there's a thousand ways that I think about why I'm so nervous about this second presidency. And I think maybe at the top of that list is because I'm probably not the person that you want to talk to about policy. There are smarter people, more informed people to talk about what Trump's policies, what they will look like when they're enacted. But I think what I feel comfortable talking with y'all about is the anxiety I have over the extent to which I think Trump is a narcissist. And I think that sometimes when we say that, we say it as a way to kind of deflect our fear or deflect the criticism that Trump might be a fascist, which for the record is a fear that I harbor, but I'm not saying that I find solace in his narcissism, and nor do I find solace in a population who worships at the feet of a narcissist. And that I think is what scares me the most. It's very, very clear to me that Trump cares first and foremost about himself, that he sees himself as the center around which the world turns and as the lens through which the world should be organized. And then the question that immediately comes to the forefront of my anxieties is something like along the lines of like, what then does that say about a people who turn to a man who embodies the promise of a world that's organized around one's desires as a kind of almost like messianic figure? Like that terrifies me. My fear here is that it says that millions of Americans might also want to organize the world around their own desires. And if that's true, or even if that's true to a degree, it signifies to me that we have to a degree abandoned both the promise and the complications of our connections and relationships to other people. And if we worship a man like that, it tells me that we've come to see the world in terms that feel fundamentally antithetical to the project of community, that we've opted for the illusion of our isolation over and above the reality and the responsibility of our relationships. And I have a hard time trying to convince myself to be hopeful in a world where that's the case. If everyone and everything that isn't I is understood as less than and in the way of I don't know where we begin. I don't know what there is really to work with. And I think Trump's rise to the precipice of culture has in many ways emptied my faith in culture. And that's a problem for an artist, because it's my responsibility to participate in and contribute to culture. And I'm left with trying first and foremost how to sustain a faith in that.
Nick Gulick, we're going to pick that up in just a minute as we go to break on the Dom Salvia Show.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Hey, Matt Rothschild with you on the Dom Salvia Show. Dom, we'll be back tomorrow. I'm guest hosting along with Angela Lang of Block, and we have Nick Gulick, the Wisconsin Poet Laureate over the last 2 years. Nick is the author of 4 books, North of Order, Book of Lake, Orient, and most recently, The Other Altar. He teaches at UW-Whitewater, and his students have got to be lucky, because what you've been giving us here has been really deep. And a couple of the texters agree. Larry from Deerfield text, thanks for having our Wisconsin Poet Laureate on the show. And again, maybe a regular Poet's Corner would be a good addition to the show going forward. We also have Todd saying the guest's words are very powerful. Thank you for this. Before the break, Nick, you were talking about, ironically, losing faith in art, and you're an artist, you're a poet, obviously. And you write in your book, Orient, art has already walked the violent path of apathy. And then you have a poem called The Path of Apathy. I love that line. I'd like you to explain it.
I think in that book, Orient, I think that line is a good line to think about it, to think about what the book is trying to think about as a whole. And it's thinking about war generally, and more specifically, I'm at that moment in time, I'm watching the civil war in Syria kind of unfold across my various screens in real time. I'm thinking about war, I'm thinking about empire, I'm thinking about racism. And when I think about those things, I think the clearest way I've found of thinking about them is as related extensions or expressions of each other, but more generally of an economic system that centers that centers experience around the accumulation of capital. It's a system that asks us to understand ourselves and to understand our relationship to other people and to the world around us through an economically dominated lens. And I think that when we do that, war, empire, and racism kind of bloom out of that way of understanding ourselves in relationship to the world. Like, from a historical perspective, we developed these racial narratives in the first place in order to justify the forms of violence that we needed to perpetuate in order to extract resources from other people and other places in the world. And so for me, to that degree, the project and the purpose of empire, which is to procure capital and thus procure power, is only possible through narratives that elevate the colonizing culture over and above the culture being colonized. So war, racism, empire, you could add words to that list.
You got to have counter narratives too, though. And that's what you're trying to do, right?
Well, trying is the right word. I don't know.
And not just you alone. There's a group of intellectuals and writers and artists and singers and cultural workers who are trying to offer a different vision of the world.
Of course. And the question for me then as a poet, if that's the case, like, how do I, not only like what is the counter narrative that I construct, but for me really as a poet, it's like how do I construct that narrative? Like, for me, the question as a poet isn't, to complicate that narrative, I need, as a poet, as an artist, I need to do that complication at a level that's larger than just the subject. Like,
Audre Lorde saying you can't take down the master's house using the master's tools? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, I'm an English speaker, so I use my tools are the master's tools. I don't know another language. Sure. Like English is my medium. I think what I mean is, like, for me, for example, to say something like "down with Donald Trump" as a line in a poem is to fail to challenge the medium in at least two really important ways. First and foremost, when I say something like that, I'm saying something that I'm insisting is the case, which is, said differently, is like to insist on meaning as something that is fixed and understood, and more specifically is understood by me. And when I write like this, I'm treating the poem as a vehicle for myself, for self, and for a version of the world that myself insists upon. When I write like that, and I oftentimes do in my early drafts, the poem gets turned into a means to an end. And so its value as a thing in the world, or as an action in the world maybe, becomes dependent and is thus like subservient to the self that seeks to use it as a way to impose order. And that brings me to the second problem, because when you're explaining to your audience that Trump sucks or whatever, you're actually taking authority away from them. You're relegating them to a position of passive consumption, and you're treating them as a receptacle for truth, and you're the one who holds that truth, and you're the one dispensing it. And this elevates the speaker over and above the listener, which to me feels like completely complicit and in line with the project of empire. And so to me, when I write like that, when my poems become like monstrous with politics to that degree, that I'd worry that they become a different version of the same thing. Because
I'm gonna have to hold you there because we're running out of time.
But I
take hope in what you wrote in Orient. Perhaps the only task is listen, translate, speak. I thought that was a really beautiful line. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you for being our guest today.
Yeah.
I thank the callers and the texters. Angela, I want to thank you. It's always great doing this.
Of course.
And Jess, thanks so much for bringing us through this. It's always great working with you as well. Dom will be back tomorrow. Everyone be safe. Have a nice holiday.
Happy holiday.
Thank you.
Hold your hand if you hold mine. The time that we kill keeps us alive.
The national news cycle never stops.
but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.